Thanks so much for staying with us here in the second hour, everyone. We are continuing our program with Ted Holden and Troy McLaughlin about their latest work, Cosmos in Collision, a prehistory of our solar system, our planet, and of modern man. It's some fascinating ideas that are coming out here, and of course we want to try to get even deeper into it and detail some of the potential problems, if you will, that arise when we begin to wade through a theory like this, and then of course try to answer some of these questions. As always, there's a lot more to go, and there's as the guys have explained as well, no one has a time machine at this point to really know exactly what has been going on, but we can do the best we can. We can try to piece things together and of course look at the available evidence. And I wanted to pick up on a note, Ted, that you left off on. You mentioned, racial memory. We can call it cellular or genetic memory as well, whatever you want to call it. It's a pretty fascinating concept, and there might be a lot of our mythology and symbolism that actually are coming from this source, if you will. But we know that modern humans and Cro-Magnon, Cro-Magnon and Neanderthals lived together at some point in history. We can certainly talk more about those conditions a little bit later. But how about dinosaurs? I mean, in the book, you guys have some petroglyphs that seem to suggest that modern humans and dinosaurs actually once were on the Earth together. Is that possible, or is this something coming out of the cellular or genetic memory, Ted? What do you think?
No, this is real. Okay, the best thing I could tell you to get hold of would be a copy of Brian DeLoria's Red Earth, White Lies. Brian DeLoria died about 6 or 7 years ago, I believe. He used to teach at the University of Colorado. He was the best known of all American Indian authors. He has several books which are standard textbooks on Indian affairs in the United States. You know, one is called Custer Died for Your Sins, okay, which is sort of a cute title. Basically, Red Earth, White Lies was meant as an antidote for what is called the Blitzkrieg hypothesis, or, you know, the overkill hypothesis, or Blitzkrieg overkill hypothesis, which attempts to blame American Indian ancestors for the extermination of the megafauna of North America 10 or 12,000 years ago. That's a long sort of a story. The book is mainly devoted to the question of whether or not American Indians could have, exterminated all of those kinds of creatures over such a gigantic space of territory. The brief answer is no, they couldn't have. You know, these creatures died in catastrophes. But Vaughn devotes one chapter to the question of dinosaurs in Indian oral traditions, right? Now, what I get reading, like, Jewish literature, Midrashim, right, Louis Ginsberg's Legends of the Jews, is that you have a handful of things in Ginsberg's legends, which, appear to be dinosaurs for all the world. So that Jewish literature records a number of things like the Reem or the Behemoth or the Zizbird, right, which appear to have been like just a handful of leftovers walking around at a period just before the flood, right? But dealing with dinosaurs was not an everyday or normal kind of a thing to anybody who was related to Adam or Eve. Right, whereas American Indian traditions talk about dealing with dinosaurs on a much more ordinary day-to-day basis, right? The Stegosaur petroglyphs, Mishi Pishu, right, that means water panther. That's almost the same word as Mississippi. The water panther is described as having red fur, a saw blade back with, and what they call a great spiked tail, which is used as a weapon. Right, Vaughn DeLoria said that was basically a stegosaur. You know, there's no, and you can see that in that one image that I present, the stegosaur glyph from Magawa Rock at Lake Superior,
yeah,
Massanaw. And, I've had people point out that, that image also has horns, but Indians were in a habit of touching those glyphs up every few years, right? The horns were added much later. I mean, just some artist figured that, a creature that size needed horns. Lewis and Clark said that their Indian gods were in mortal terror at the sight of these glyphs around the Mississippi River. The original intention of the glyphs was caution. One of these things lives here, right? What I believe happened was that the stegosaur, after the change in gravity, moved into water to try to deal with these greater weight. But he didn't have any real adaptation for water, right? And he didn't survive in water for very long. you know, this was a sort of an ancient reality. Now, scientists and engineers used to believe that all sauropod dinosaurs lived in water, but nobody believes that anymore. That they had no adaptation for water. Sauropod teeth show the kinds of wear and tear that you get from eating branches and leaves. I mean, you don't get that from eating water vegetation. That water vegetation is soft. They would have needed snowshoe-like feet. The feet they actually had would go straight into muddy river bottoms. They wouldn't be able to walk. You know, they had no adaptation for anything like that. That's basically what I get from petroglyphs. You've got numerous dinosaur petroglyphs.
If I could interject here as well, for the listener's sake, the change in gravity, of course, is related to what we're saying is Earth's relationship to Saturn being disrupted by the capture of Saturn by the Sun. You get this massive change in the electrostatic environment on a grand cosmic scale. According to the Electric Universe model, you also get a change in gravity, and this is what accounts for possibly a die-off. But if I might just add, Ted, people who might think that it's somewhat desperate speculation on our part in terms of Indian, petroglyphs and so on, also have to account for soft tissue in the discovery of dinosaur bones.
That's ongoing. In fact, they're actually getting some of the soft tissue radiocarbon dating. You know, they've actually got a radiocarbon date of about 25,000 years for one particular mosasaur specimen. And that kind of, according to theory, that stuff shouldn't radiocarbon date. I mean, the extreme limit of radiocarbon is going to be about 50,000 years.
So wait a minute. Let's just clarify that. You're telling me that soft tissue from dinosaurs dates back to about 25,000 years at this point?
If you believe the radiocarbon date,
yeah.
It might, like I say, it might be more like 15, in real life, if you have the time machine to figure it out, it might be more like 15 or 20,000 years. I don't know.
But that's still pretty good. It upsets the regular theory by millions of years, nonetheless.
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. The point is that if dinosaurs, according to the accepted theory, died out mega million years ago and so on, how did soft tissue survive in the bones? To the point that in some of the sites some of the labs that have received these bones talk about, Ted, that smell of almost like a graveyard smell?
Yeah, graveyard smell. They're not talking about the stuff that they bring into laboratories. They're saying that the site where they're picking this stuff up has a graveyard smell to it, so that they're smelling decay and flesh smells, right? I mean, they're finding blood and blood vessels and collagen and just regular, meat like you'd find in a grocery store, and dinosaur bones, and at first it just seemed like a freak accident or something. I mean, you had the one tyrannosaur bone that they had to break in half to get back to their laboratories. That they had a small helicopter, which was the only way in and out of that area. It's in either Montana or North Dakota, right? At any rate, since that time, this has been a number of years now. It's like they've been finding more and more of this sort of thing in different kinds of bones. Recently, there have been articles about soft tissue and tyrannosaur and mosasaur remains. Okay, you've got like one duckbill dinosaur that a hadrosaur, which they found, which is almost completely mummified. Which is like large amounts of soft tissue, and the reports which came out at the time they first found that were using terms like gobsmacked. Researchers were saying they were just completely floored.
Absolutely fascinating. I mean, it upsets everything. It was something more you wanted to add to that, Ted?
Yeah, petroglyphs. I mean, they find numerous American petroglyphs with recognizable images of known dinosaur types. You've got like sauropod petroglyphs, both in Havasupai and in Utah, like at Natural Bridges, the Kachina Bridge. You've got something which is obviously a sauropod dinosaur. You've got, several variations of this sort of thing. Apparently, if you go back 200 or 300 years, to the time of Lewis and Clark, these stegosaur glyphs were common. There are one or two of those still left now, particularly the one at Igalwa Rock. But apparently, like I say, I mean, when the Europeans first got here, it was sort of a common thing.
Now, we'll return and talk more about Ganymede here soon. There's much more to talk about it when it comes to that moon. I just wanted to ask you, Troy, about how you believe Cro-Magnon and the Neanderthals kind of lived together, and if there was Well, there are two different ideas here. There are some suggesting that the Cro-Magnon actually killed off the Neanderthals. There was a hunt on that end, and counteracting that is something like Danny Vendramini's theories that you brought up earlier from his work, Them and Us, where he basically suggests that there was the Neanderthals that actually, you know, hunted modern human. But what we know so far is that Neanderthals died off, and you know, we're still here. What do you think happened, Troy? What played out there?
Well, we have a chapter where we talk about the distinct possibility that there was a Paleolithic world war fought between Cro-Magnon and Neanderthals, and that this was basically an extermination program on the part of Cro-Magnons to get rid of this threat that they faced when it came to Neanderthals. Ted can explain this a lot better than I can, in terms of the way that the Neanderthal operated and what made him such a threat to Cro-Magnons. But the fact of the matter is that Vendramini's particular theories, his Them and Us thesis of Neanderthal predation, is what he points to as being the accelerant supposedly for human evolution. The fact that these things came after us and, what do you call it, Ted? You saw us as meat on the hoof.
That's about the way I would describe it. Now, you have to understand there are several facets of Danny Vendramini's thesis, some of which are more believable than others. I believe Vendramini's description of the Neanderthal is dead on, with one or two very small exceptions. Troy and I don't believe that the Neanderthal had slit eyes to deal with daylight. We don't believe that he ever saw daylight. We don't buy into Vendramini's idea of predation by Neanderthals driving gracile hominids into some kind of a fast process of evolution, you know, such as Stephen Gould and Miles Eldridge described, right, to become Cro-Magnon man. That to us is not plausible. For any kind of a hominid to have evolved into modern man, he would have to have lost his fur coat while an ice age was going on. He would have to have lost almost all of his sense of smell while trying to survive as a land prey animal. He would have to have lost his fur, fur coat. He'd have to have lost almost all of his night vision in an age when night was the only time of day that there was, right? So in other words, you know, if that doesn't sound like a formula for success to you, then, it doesn't sound like a formula for success to Troy or myself either. You know, that doesn't work, okay? There would be some kind of a run-up. You know, in other words, there would be evidence in the ground of any kind of a creature having evolved into Cro-Magnon man, whereas in real life, Cro-Magnon man appears on the planet fully formed. You know, all of these basic hobbies and skills and character traits and capabilities were there from the first day that he ever set foot on the planet. All of the artwork, all of the fancy kinds of weaponry, you know, harpoons, fishing hooks, needles. Okay, I mean, Cro-Magnon needles are common. Nobody's ever found the first Neanderthal needle. You know, a creature with a 6-inch long fur coat doesn't need needles.
Yeah.
So that the Neanderthal was the absolute apex predator of Ice Age Europe. He had basically become a very, I mean, there were other kinds of hominids walking around during the same time and before the Neanderthal, right? And they had different kinds of sizes and shapes and characteristics. The Neanderthal was the natural born killer amongst hominids. I mean, his diet was 100% meat. He wasn't eating veggies or anything like that, or at least not in, in some parts of the world he might have been, right, but not in Ice Age Europe. I mean, there were no vegetables worth trying to go after in Ice Age Europe. So you've got a very talented and capable creature. You've got a creature that could see in the dark, right? You've got a creature that walked on two legs, that carried spears. It didn't have the kinds of shoulders that we have, which are good for throwing things. In other words, the Neanderthal was using thrusting spears, and he was killing mammoths and woolly rhinos with thrusting spears, so that you find injuries amongst Neanderthal remains, which are similar to what you get with rodeo riders, in the modern age. It's a hard way to earn a living, right?
Right.
Their bones healed, right? I mean, their fellows took care of them. They find bones in Neanderthal caves which have been butchered, right? Neanderthal bones. There was a cannibalistic creature. There's no question about that. I mean, they find enough of that sort of thing to understand that the Neanderthal you know, was cannibalistic. He apparently viewed the living world as being neatly divided into two groups, that is, his own family group and meat. Okay, that says that the mindset of a Neanderthal was not like our mindset. It was more like the mindset of an African lion. You understand what I'm saying? So that you've got a creature which is just completely different from modern humans. They would have presented a threat when humans first got to this planet. I mean, you know, it wouldn't have presented a military-type threat. I mean, you wouldn't have had any sort of a Neanderthal scheme to exterminate humans, but you would have had hunting bands of Neanderthals trying to snag a human here and there and carrying them off to their own camp and cook them and eat them, right? Now, typically amongst modern predators, you've got cats, which generally have the decency to kill something and then eat it, right?
Right.
But, you know, you've got dogs and hyenas and things like that, which don't. I mean, they'll just grab things and start eating, right? I mean, the cats usually will try to kill something first, but it's not guaranteed, right? If you get, like, lions hungry enough, I mean, they'll occasionally start eating a buffalo before he's really dead. And then in the case of warthogs, I mean, they apparently just like to listen to them squeal. And there's no particular, in other words, if you go to watch some of these kill scenes on YouTube, some of them are pretty gruesome. Right.
Yeah.
And no particular reason to believe that Neanderthals would have been that much different. Right. Now, it seems reasonable enough to me that, you know, that Cro-Magnon people would only need to have seen something like that happen to one of their own number once. You understand what I'm saying?
And that would have been the incentive for them to actually permanently try to target them and go after them. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. As soon as the Cro-Magnons got their numbers up.
Yeah.
Then they declared an all-out genocidal war against not only the Neanderthal but all hominids. Right? I mean, there were just no survivors.
Yeah. Wow. So this is how we prevailed basically with our wits and our tool making and organization, as opposed to the conditions changing, this becoming a brighter world or something like that.
There were a number of factors which favored humans in that struggle. Okay, one factor was that the Neanderthal had fire, but he was not able, he had to be much more careful about using it than we did. In other words, you know, this is the thing about the fur coat. I mean, an incident which would cause a minor burn to a human would most likely light a Neanderthal up like a torch and fry him. Hmm. Okay, you had projectile weapons, which the Neanderthal never had. This included, at some point it started to include archery and bows and arrows, but the thing which it included early on was what you call the atlatl, or a spear thrower. Okay, in the Americas, that's called an atlatl. That's the Mexican name for it, or the Aztec name for it. In the outback in Australia, that's called woomera, right? But it's exactly the same kind of a thing as a hard serve in a tennis match, right? In other words, what you get like watching Andy Roddick or, you know, or one of your other players with hard serves is trading 3 inches of wrist motion for 4 feet of racket head motion in the blink of an eye, right? That sends a tennis ball off at 140 miles an hour. Now, if instead of a tennis racket, what you've got is a stick, which is about 2.5 feet long with a hook on the end of it, and then you've got a six-foot-long spear, you know, with a sharpened point or with a stone point, and an indentation in the back of the spear, right? And when the user snaps his wrist, it's sending the 6-foot-long spear off at 100 miles an hour. That's something you don't want to be standing in front of, okay? So that the assumption I would make is that, you know, when the Cro-Magnons went out after Neanderthals, then, you know, they would go in groups of 100 people or so, and they would have these spear throwers, and they would have dogs, you know, to nullify the advantage which the Neanderthal had at night. And they would have fire with them. They would have every fifth, sixth, or seventh person was going to be carrying a torch for the benefit of any Neanderthal that got past the projectile weapons. You understand what I'm saying? It was pretty one-sided. You know, the other thing that you have to understand is Neanderthal lived by the family group. I mean, he apparently never realized he was in a war until it was too late. And it's probably the case that a Cro-Magnon war party never had to have any more than, you know, as far as numbers, never had to have more than about double the size of the largest Neanderthal family group, which they figured to encounter. You know, so that at some point, everything was on the side of the Cro-Magnons. It's like I said, it would be pretty one-sided. We, you know, the subtitle that we use in the book is Predator versus Warrior.
Yeah.
you know, and that kind of a struggle, the warrior is going to win.
Well, that's right. It's very interesting, you know, ideas here, and we might return a little bit more to that later. I do want to spend some more time on Ganymede, though. You guys have a lot of material about it in the book, and I wanted to shift over to you again, Troy, and just see where some of the things that we can explain. You know, obviously the conditions were different than they are today, and we can certainly talk about even what happened to Ganymede. But more you want to say about the conditions that existed when life, you know, arose as we know it then?
You mean on Ganymede?
Yeah, that's right.
Such a why it's conducive to life? Yes. As discussed in our the first hour, we looked at the idea that Jupiter, almost by default, without the other planets, would have been in a much closer orbit to the Sun. It would have conformed to pretty much how we see other planets of that size around other main sequence stars. And as a result of that, it's pretty clear that whatever water was found on the moons that surround Jupiter at that time, had there been an atmosphere, and there's every reason to believe there was an atmosphere, those moons would have had liquid oceans if Jupiter was actually orbiting in what's called the habitable zone, or the within the frost line of the solar system. But what made this project so fascinating for me when we started going after, you know, really, as I said earlier on in the first hour, it was kind of a task of finding a world which was conducive to the type of creature that humans represent, the adaptations that we have. And while I was convinced that Earth under Saturn, when that system was not within the solar system, had been a semi-permanent, totally permanent, semi-nocturnal world, finding this bright world, was a challenge that we had. And as we approach sort of looking at Jupiter in that situation, and ultimately looking at the terrestrial moons, what we found was that of all the bodies in the solar system, and I include Mars and Venus and these other terrestrial planets that we have, probably the most Earth-like of them all is Ganymede. And I've been at a loss to understand why Ganymede has not actually been the focus of more attention. There's more attention on Europa. There's more attention on Callisto. Yeah. And it's only recently there's even more attention on Titan, a satellite of Saturn at this time. But there has been a sudden change. Ted and I became very aware, just as we were, going to print, so to speak, with the Kindle, that there was a major conference that in Russia, where some of the big authority figures on the Galilean moons were being gathered to discuss refocusing efforts of sending probes and potential missions to Ganymede. Now, Ganymede, as I said, earlier on, was fascinating because it is the most Earth-like. And what do I mean by that? Probably the most important thing when you're looking for a terrestrial body to support human life as we know it is that that body must be protected against cosmic radiation. Now, sub-brown dwarf stars, if you're close enough to them, they have a tendency to give off a tremendous amount of radiation. If Earth were, as we postulate, under Saturn, existing as a satellite of Saturn, it would have had to have been protected from this radiation in the same way that we are protected today. And the way that that's achieved by any terrestrial body is through what's called a magnetosphere. And Ganymede is the only other object in the solar system that we can actually put boots on, get people down there, that has its own intrinsic magnetosphere. Venus has a very powerful magnetosphere, but that's a living hell. And as Ted alluded to earlier on, that's largely a result of Venus actually being, a result pretty much of the capture of Saturn, where in Saturn theory it's believed that Venus was ejected by Saturn, and so therefore is a very, very recent planet. But in terms of the bodies that are terrestrial in our solar system, just that alone, the magnetosphere, makes Ganymede, in my opinion, one of the what should be one of our primary focus in terms of looking for potentially, you know, life off Earth. Now, the magnetosphere that Ganymede has is very important in regards to Jupiter, because Jupiter, unlike Saturn at this time, Jupiter has tremendously dangerous radiation, particularly for humans. So if we put people on to, let's say, Europa, which is well within the radiation belts of Jupiter, they are going to be exposed to extremely high doses of radiation. We have to have some serious protection for them, or, you know, technology that can somehow keep them alive. If we put them on Callisto, Callisto is far enough outside of the radiation belt that they're not going to be affected so much by that. But cosmic radiation still is a problem on Callisto, because Callisto does not have an intrinsic magnetosphere. A lot of these other bodies have what's called an induced magnetosphere. It's this, it's the bands of magnetic fields that basically block radiation coming in. Ganymede is, as I say, almost unique in this in its capacity to have its own magnetosphere. And of course, given the size of Ganymede, it's about a third of the size. Two-thirds, I think, of the size, I might be wrong, two-thirds of the size of Mars, in size. How it actually generates a magnetosphere according to mainstream theories is not really fully understood by the mainstream. The electric universe, however, provides a perfect example, and that is that it's not an internal mechanism, it's just simply part of the moon's electrical relationship with its host planet, Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
And this relationship with having this magnetosphere, also having water, which is your next best protection against radiation, produces a world where you can actually exist almost free of the effects of radiation like we do here on Earth. That in itself was an indicator that Ganymede should really be one of the most important focuses for exploration, for finding life, simply because of that one factor alone. But there are many others.
And tell us a little bit about how, if we went to Ganymede today, do you think we still would find life, or just signs of previous life?
My bet is that there would be signs of previous life. Now, the reason I say this is that in connection to Saturn theory, of course, you've got this idea that at what is a fairly recent epoch, the Saturnian system invades the Sun's solar system, gets captured, and in the process, Jupiter is pushed out to its current orbit, taking its four Galilean moons and all its other, you know, the whole 64 satellites it has with it, where it resides now outside of this frost zone. So what you get is in the catastrophic phase of Saturn's entry into the solar system, any life that exists in a water world that would have been Ganymede, by being pushed outside the frost line, it immediately begins to freeze. Also, you would get a tremendous amount of enhanced electrical activity just simply from the reaction, the interaction between these vast celestial bodies coming into electrical contact with each other. You would get these massive electrical thunderbolts being thrown out by Jupiter. And in fact, mythology tells us that Jupiter used to put on some of the biggest displays. It's where we get our concept in mythology of the Jovian thunderbolt, the wrath of God, the wrath of Zeus, visiting destruction and so on like that. Now, that seemed bad enough for the inhabitants of Earth witnessing this. We can only imagine what that effect would have been on Ganymede itself. And in fact, we can actually see the effects. And the effects indicate to us that Ganymede did in fact enjoy a rich atmosphere at one point. Now, to qualify what I'm saying there, just as another point, Ganymede is apart from Europa, Ganymede is the only moon to show trace oxygen atmosphere or exosphere. Now that atmosphere, we are saying in Cosmos and Collision, was burned off when Jupiter shifted to its current orbit. The waters froze on Ganymede Jupiter's electrical thunderbolts reached out, scarring the planet electrically, and it is in those scars that we can see the evidence for what is called atmospheric discharge. And the evidence for that are these Lichtenberg patterns that we see all over Ganymede that are erroneously called by mainstream science impact craters. But in fact are evidence of these giant electric thunderbolts that simply would have burnt off what atmosphere was on Ganymede at that particular time, and have left their telltale signature on Ganymede, on Europa. You see these effects, and in Cosmos in Collision, we go into quite a lot of detail in analyzing these features in the ice of these moons. We reject the notion that they are conforming to what we see in pack ice around Earth, and that in fact what we see is evidence of massive electrical interaction between Jupiter and its moons.
Tell us as well a little bit about the, well, basically there's an enigma here of Ganymede's, you know, the moment of inertia, and you guys explain this a little bit with how the core is composed and stuff like that.
Well, one of the biggest difficulties that I had, let's say it was a very interesting project where in searching for this bright world where liquid water could have existed in an oxygen atmosphere with a sufficient magnetosphere to provide, you know, protection from the radiation, we came up against this, this concept that Ganymede has the lowest moment of inertia of all celestial bodies in the solar system. Now, that's physics talk for a body that has most of its mass concentrated at its core, while the outer parts of the body are actually very light, very thin. And what mainstream science has decided is that this dense concentration of Ganymede's mass at its core means that there is up to 800 kilometers thick water surrounding the planet. So you have basically an iron core with a small rock silicate inner mantle or outer core, and then you've got the majority of the mantle stretching for 800, to a depth of 800 kilometers, where you have this ice water that forms this vast ocean. Then covering that ice water that they've got is the actual crust that we see on the surface, which is around about 40 to maybe 100 kilometers thick. Now, the reason that they picked water was twofold. They were looking for something to facilitate the electric activity that sustained Ganymede's magnetosphere. That was one factor, and they decided a salt ocean. But they looked on water as being the answer from the thermal evolution dynamic that is applied to the formation of planets, as being the correct lightness of weight, the density of weight, to provide that moment of inertia. Now, what do we mean by a moment of inertia? For people to visualize a moment of inertia, think of an ice skater putting on a show where, and we've seen them where they come to do a twirl in the middle of the ice, and they spin around on their ice skates. And the faster they go, they bring their arms in into a tighter mass inside, and that's how they generate speed. Well, Ganymede is kind of like the ultimate ice skater in the solar system. To get it spinning would require very little force. I should point out that at this time it's in phase lock with with Jupiter, mm-hmm. So it has the same face facing Jupiter at all times. But that low moment of inertia is, an application of its mass being concentrated at the center, just in the same way that an ice skater does to generate speed in one of their spins. Now, the problem with this, of course, is that when you've got 800 kilometers of ocean followed by a crust that is itself extremely deep, we're saying that a liquid world, in this antique solar system epoch, you have this massive problem where, basically you have over 800 kilometer depth of oceans, which seems untenable. What I found was, what we propose actually in Cosmos and Collision is that Ganymede's outer core, or mantle, the one that they believe is just ice water. Mm-hmm. We are proposing that actually it's made of pumice. A rock silicate material that has a lot of air bubbles or gas bubbles inside of it. And here on Earth, we see pumice as a result of volcanic activity. Pumice can float on water. It's actually lighter than water. So if you have an 800-kilometer mantle, thick mantle made of pumice, you get exactly the same properties that the low moment of inertia that they've measured would need, and that would account for its low moment of inertia. Of course, we have the problem of how did something, how did you get a pumice mantle, in terms of its creation on Ganymede, in a world where quite obviously there isn't the volcanic activity that we even see on Io. Io, one of the other moons of Jupiter, is much more volcanically active, and we don't see 800-kilometer thick pumice mantles being formed. So how did this pumice mantle get formed? And our solution to that is that at some point in the past, the Birkeland currents that connected the moon Ganymede to Jupiter would have gone into arc mode, probably as a result of the birth of one or two of the other moons that make up the Galilean moons. For argument's sake, let's say Io and Europa. The Birkeland current connecting Ganymede would have gone into arc mode and would have proceeded to electrically cook Ganymede in its original form with an outer rocky silicate mantle. That cooking process would have been to such a depth that when Jupiter did turn off, or when the arc mode of the Birkeland current suddenly changed, the resulting implosion of pressure, whether it be atmospheric or straightforward space, would have immediately transformed that mantle into this huge layer of pumice, and thereby giving Ganymede its extremely low moment of inertia. Now, this is very important to our theory to come up with this, because what that provided us with was the basis for an environment whereby the ice crust that we see becomes the ocean over the top of this pumice mantle, and the shards of pumice, the dust of pumice that you would have left over, provide the what you would call the landforms of Ganymede when its waters were in a liquid state, to the effect that essentially think of sort of icebergs, broken pack ice, but substitute that pack ice for the broken shards of pumice, and you get a world which is predominantly water, with these free floating sort of landforms made of pumice that float on the water. Pumice being lighter than water, and the dust silicate that is left over from this electrical baking, this effect from forming the pumice, goes towards producing the organic, the soils and the organics that you would need. Now, that produces a world where you have pumicebergs floating around, coagulating, drifting on the currents of this liquid ocean. And one of the things that was really exciting in discovering some of Ganymede's traits is that, in fact, what you would expect to find is that in the ice of Ganymede you would find collections of rocks or rock-like substance, silicate-like substance. And this is exactly what we do actually find on Ganymede. We find these anomalies where scientists just cannot understand why you have collections of rock suspended in the ice. That we see there's at least three identified areas where you've got these big coagulations of rock, these collections of rocks. The idea that these were delivered to Ganymede via impactors doesn't ring true, simply because if Ganymede had always been ice, as the mainstream theory suggests, then why did they all collect into specific areas? It's much more logical to believe that if the ice were liquid, the currents would basically create that coagulating effect. You've seen stuff, leaves in the swimming pool always seem to pool into each other rather than spread evenly throughout the pool. Now, the same thing is happening with these rocks, according to our theory. The idea also that rocks would impact the rocks from meteorites would actually float in water to create these sort of rocky islands, these collections of rocks at various points on the planet, is also quite quite simply unbelievable. So it's our position that these anomalous bundles of rocks that they find suspended in the ice actually are the last vestiges of the pumice icebergs. The pumicebergs,
yeah.
that would have been the main feature, the main sort of land feature of Ganymede during its liquid ocean stage when Jupiter was much closer into the sun.
Hmm. How about that? So much to discover, of course, about these worlds that we are yet to visit. And do you know, recall, yeah. Troy, if there's any, missions in the work to explore some of the Jovian moons in more detail?
Oh yeah, most definitely. The idea of going to Jupiter and using the moons as sort of like a base for a launch into even further exploration of the outer solar system has always been on the cards, and Callisto was originally identified as the best option for that, simply because it was outside of the radiation belt. That Jupiter emits and such. But there has definitely been, I haven't really got to the bottom of it. We're still waiting to see what results came from a conference, but the Russians held this big conference where the focus is now changing. They're actually changing, the proposed probe landings of Callisto and Europa, and they're deciding that Ganymede is possibly the place they want to go to.
Hmm.
They won't be going there for the reasons that we postulate and so on, but there are predictions, I'm sure, that can be deduced from Cosmos and Collision as to what they might find depending on where they get there. Certainly, I expect that they will find evidence of organic substances in the ice, locked in the ice. In Cosmos and Collision, I give a fairly decent discussion on how these organic substances would have been formed, in relation to the demise of Ganymede when Jupiter was pushed out to the outer realms.
Yeah, really interesting. Now, I wanted to talk about, I wanted to give you some opportunity here as well towards the end here and talk more about if there's anything else in the book, of course, that both of you find interesting and that we could just briefly talk about. But there's one thing I want to ask you more about. In the book, you propose basically a new theory of how planets are formed. It's based on something called Herbig-Haro objects that actually are observed throughout the galaxy.
Right.
I don't know which one of you are the experts on that, but maybe we can talk about that a little bit.
Troy is really more the expert on Herbig-Haro objects. Basically, what you're talking about is cosmic Birkeland currents and the Z-pinch effect that you get with cosmic Birkeland currents causing objects to form in groups, right? Particularly, you see strings of galaxies in the universe, which shouldn't be there according to standard theories. And then you get bodies which seem to be forming with axial alignments. Okay, so that you get these kinds of axial alignments, which we had in the ancient solar system with Saturn and then Mars and Earth, right? And these are highly counterintuitive, I mean, just based on present reality. But again, I think Troy is more like the expert on that sort of thing.
Yeah, Henrik, I'm quite excited because this is a contribution. When I wrote Saturn Death Cult that you and I have had previous interviews dealing with, I was no innovator in Saturn theory. I was merely sort of putting into context some of the physics that's proposed by Saturn theory to explain some of the archetypes that come down through mythology, even down to us today. Of course, listeners can go back to some of those interviews that we did to have a look at that.
Yep.
But what is exciting about this is that, of course, there's all kinds of theories in Saturn theory to try and explain the mythological record. And while mythology most definitely does place Saturn at Earth's north celestial pole in ancient times, the only way this could have been possible is if, one, Earth had originally orbited Saturn as the Moon orbits the Earth today, i.e. in a phase-locked configuration where anyone observing Earth from the Moon would see the Earth at a permanent stationary point. All right. The second configuration is that if the Earth were in a permanent position beneath Saturn's south pole, sharing the same rotational axis. Now, this last idea, the second idea, is the most controversial. But what we have to remember is that, you know, as alluded to before, there are certain traits of certain planets in our current solar system that point to these planets as being alien, you know, to the Sun. The most prominent traits are these divergences we've spoken of in the axial tilts of the planets. At least four of the planets, Earth, Mars, Saturn, and Neptune, share almost identical tilts of between 23 and 27 degrees. While the other planets, Mercury and Jupiter, the other main planets, you know, at this time, have almost perfectly upright tilts matching that of the Sun. This would indicate that Mercury and Jupiter were formed in conjunction with the Sun, while the other mentioned planets shared a different origin. Now, I've left out Venus and Uranus as part of that because the former, Venus, Venus's history indicates a very recent origin that Ted touched on before, and that we relate to the actual capture of Saturn by the Sun, a result of Saturn going nova and ejecting a body which later became the planet Venus.
Yeah.
The latter of these planets, Uranus, seems to have suffered a truly catastrophic encounter that gave it its, you know, present bizarre 95-degree tilt. Now, we can go more into that later, but I believe that Uranus was actually the leading planet arriving into the solar system and basically bore the brunt of the initial contact of the Saturnian planet. So you had Uranus at the top, Neptune below that, Saturn below that in the middle, next Mars and Earth right at the bottom. And they're spiraling upwards into the Sun, and Uranus met a rather, you know, more catastrophic, had a more catastrophic encounter on its entry into the solar system. So in the meantime, these divergent tilts that we spoke about are what we would expect if Saturn and Earth, Mars and Neptune were alien interlopers to the Sun system. Facts that are completely at odds with the solar nebula disk model that people are most familiar with for the formation of planets. That is an inert gas cloud on the equatorial plane coagulating or accreting into planetary bodies. Now, in Cosmos in Collision, we reject the notion that mythology points to a phase-locked relationship between Earth and Saturn. And we've opted for the more controversial polar configuration where Earth resides beneath Saturn's south pole. For many people, this idea that Saturn was literally stacked above Earth at one time, like two beads dangling on a string, and where both shared the same rotation of axis, well, this is almost an untenable concept according to understanding of modern celestial mechanics or physics.
Yep.
So this reported, you know, polar arrangement from mythology between Saturn and Earth is largely why I believe the mythological record has been relegated in the modern era by most as being works of fiction, and has led to many scholars of mythology force-fitting our current Sun into the roles that ancient mythology originally ascribed to Saturn.
To Saturn, yeah.
And this is also largely, as we discussed, because things don't look that way today. We don't have Saturn up on the celestial north. It's assumed that the way things look today is how they must have looked back in ancient times. Yet, the ancient record is insistent that Saturn originally sat at Earth's celestial north, and in the book we provide evidence for this. Of course, detractors will also point out that we seemingly have no evidence for existing celestial objects arranged in this type of axial alignment, and that this polar configuration where both objects share the same rotational axis, you know, basically is at odds with celestial mechanics. The problem with this criticism, as Ted discussed before, is that we actually do observe such formations, and we do so on an increasingly more frequent scale. And that's why we've introduced what we call our Herbig-Haro solution for the formation of axially aligned planets, and particular for the formation of celestial objects that conform to this polar configuration as reported in ancient mythology. It appears to us that Saturn and its original satellites, including Earth, began life as part of a Herbig-Haro object, which eventually broke apart into two separate planetary systems and then rejoined cataclysmically at a later date, and that rejoining happened within the collective memory of humankind and has come down to us in the form of mythology. But the Herbig-Haro object that we allude to These are seen, I think at last count they're approaching 300 of them have been spotted various places in the galaxy. And without doubt, what they are protostars that have these giant polar jets emanating out from their north poles and their south poles in these straight lines. And along these polar jets, you find beads of plasma, you know, basically coagulating. And these beads of plasma rotate in axial alignment with the protostar, much exactly in the same way as we're talking about Earth under Saturn. Mainstream science doesn't really look at these jets. They consider them to be gas jets. This is despite the fact that if you fire gas out into a near vacuum, it doesn't form a jet like a water hose does. It just dissipates the gas. Yet somehow they stick with this idea that these are just simply gas jets, and that's all we've got there in terms of plasma. The Electric Universe, on the other hand, identifies these polar jets as our famous Birkeland currents, these electrical, literally power lines that power the universe. And that where you see these beads coagulating on the length of these Birkeland currents is where you are getting Z pinches taking place that basically attract through magnetic force iron, various objects to form cores, to form these plasma beads. Now, we can't see into these plasma beads, but we are suggesting that planetary formation is actually taking place in these plasma beads. Now, when the protostar starts to go mainstream, i.e. become a full star, that Birkeland current will be disrupted. And any collection of plasma beads that would have been on its southern or northern Birkeland current collecting, well, they would basically be on their own at that point. And we are suggesting this is exactly what happened. Our sun started life off as a protostar with these Birkeland current jets that the northern jet basically facilitated the creation of what we know as Jupiter with its moons and Mercury, Pluto, maybe one or two other planets. That the southern jet formed Uranus, Neptune, in descending order, Saturn, Mars and Earth. And that when the sun actually went to the mainstream, the sun continued on its northern drift, captured the northern set of planets, Jupiter and such, formed the solar system on its equatorial plane, while the southern beads were left to continue in their you know, in their current alignment. Mm-hmm. And that alignment was maintained by the very powerful Birkeland currents that Saturn would have had as a sub-brown dwarf star, with Earth trapped underneath it in its in a Z-pinch inside this Birkeland current, safe in its own magnetosphere. Now, when that entire planetary system was cut loose by the protosun, it started to drift on a deep spiral pattern, and eventually plasmasphere of the Saturnian system came into contact with the sun's heliosphere, which is basically the sun's plasmasphere. And this had all kinds of implications for, you know, what whatever life had developed on Earth at that time. And as we're suggesting, if Ganymede were in fact at that time the place of origin for human life, at this point we are suggesting this is how life was transferred early on. Human life was transferred early on. This was the opportunity for the transfer of human life from Ganymede to Earth. This connection, this collision, would have first been a brushing as Saturn came up from below the sun, touched plasma sheaths, spiraled back out, as Ted has suggested, leaving Cro-Magnon man, had he, you know, at that point transferred, left to fend for himself in a in an alien dark world. And anywhere upwards between 30,000 years later, final capture into the solar system as a whole, and the beginning of what we call the golden age of mythology, when Saturn flared up nova-like and that let there be light moment started on the Earth.
Wow, what a story. There, of course, is a lot more to it, and you know, we'll point people to the book for more information on this, Cosmos in Collision. TEDx.com is a website for that. And also, Ted, I wanted to ask you a little bit here as we're coming towards the end here of our time for this time, if there's any other additions that you'd like to make here to the discussion, something you find interesting that you can leave as a tidbit for our audience?
Certainly.
Oh, yeah, sir. Go ahead, Troy.
Sorry. What I suggest as well is that, one of the reasons that Ted and I sort of adopted this was, of course, the distances involved in a Haber-Caro object, which conform very much with what Ted was telling me were untenable concepts in existing Saturn theory in terms of, Saturn arriving from a sub-dwarf galaxy colliding and so on like that. And, Ted very much convinced me that we needed, a close proximity.
Okay, let me run by two things here then. I had one in mind. Troy's just added another. We believe that the way I would describe it is that we have determined the original home of modern humans to within what I would call a statistical certainty, meaning that for us to be wrong about Ganymede having been the original home of modern man, some kind of a zero probability event or what I would call a probabilistic miracle would have to have occurred. What that means is that either humans would have to have come from something exactly like Ganymede, which has since been destroyed and no longer exists, which would be one flavor of a probabilistic miracle. And the other flavor of a probabilistic miracle would be to have modern man arrive from cosmic space, from the reaches of interstellar space. Now, most people don't have any sort of an idea of how vast those kinds of distances are. They hear you watch Star Trek and you hear the term light years, right? And it sort of goes in one ear and out the other.
Yeah.
The best description of it I've heard comes from Donald Scott. Basically, he noted that if you were to scale our solar system to be about a yard in diameter, that is to have the orbit of Pluto be about 1 yard in diameter, then at that scale, the sun would be about the width of a human hair. The Earth and Mars would be an inch and a half away from the sun. And the nearest other star, which is Alpha Centauri, would be about 4.2 miles out in the distance. Okay? And these distances are fairly typical for the Milky Way. In other words, even in clusters and parts of the Milky Way, which appear to be bright, these are still the same kinds of distances that you see between stars. We've got what they call a dozen or a couple of dozen near stars, which are within, say, 4, 5, 6, 10, 20 light years. Everything else is out further than that, right? To picture any one star ever capturing another star, given those kinds of distances, is a probabilistic miracle. Also, having humans arrive from interstellar space, I would categorize as a probabilistic miracle. I normally rule those kinds of things out. Occam's principle, which is often called Occam's razor, says that, when you have two competing theories with equal explanatory power, you generally go with the simpler version of the theory, right? You prefer the simpler explanation, right? So that when you've got a perfect world for a human prehistory sitting there in the form of Ganymede, and anything else is going to represent some kind of an outright zero probability event, then you have to go with this. You understand what I'm saying? This is what Troy had in mind, was just the question of cosmic distances. I believe that Duardo Cardona favors the idea of Saturn having arrived in the proximity of our present sun from deep space, right? I would rule that out. In other words, I would say that Troy's explanation of Haber-Caro chains of objects is probably the only rational explanation that there is for, the original situation where you had the sun and Jupiter and Mercury, and then you had Saturn, Uranus, or Neptune, rather, and then Mars and Earth. Okay,
I should also just point out that it's a strange thing there, because it is actually Cardona who brought Haber-Caro objects to, my attention. Mm-hmm. And such, yet he still seems to insist in his writing this other process, and that right. I think he thinks that Saturn formed its own Haber-Caro, arrangement. But given what Ted's saying is why I favor this particular approach.
Ah,
Right. I mean, I would have to go with Troy's version of this. Now, you'd asked if there was anything else which I thought might be worth talking about, and there is. And this is something which was subtle enough that Troy and I all but missed it. Okay, and this is the question of the ramifications of having discovered a dual living world or double living worlds in this ancient system, right? And this involves the question of how somebody who believed that our living world was just a completely random thing would have to view science fiction. Troy and I believe that we've created 100 years worth of work for science fiction writers and for romance novel writers. Okay, so I mean, there's going to be a lot more to follow here. I mean, as far as like just trying to describe life in this prehistoric world, you know, particularly Ganymede. Nonetheless, if you believe that our living world had arisen via random events and just combinations of mutation and selection, then you would have to believe that if you were to travel out into the cosmos and find another star with its own, you know, with its own planets and some kind of a living world on one of those planets, you know, that what you would see would be completely alien, right? In other words, you know, this would be like the cafe in Star Wars where you see creatures whose morphology is limited only by the writer's imagination. You know, you wouldn't expect to see, you know, the same information. You know, our living world is governed by an information system, which is called DNA RNA. It's essentially a programming language like C++ or Java, right? You wouldn't expect to see anything familiar if you were to arrive in another star system and find a living world which you assume would have simply been created by the same kinds of random events, you know, which created ours, right? Whereas by the same token, if you were to go to another star, you know, like 50 light years out there and find another living world on one of its planets, and what you saw was, you know, just the same kinds of dogs and cats and spiders and flies and humans and monkeys and apes and birds and fish that you'd been seeing, and everything you saw was based on the same DNA RNA system of information, then at that point, you just get clobbered over the head, right? In other words, you're going to have to rethink. You're going to have to at least consider the possibility that our living world is completely governed by information, and that information system probably operates the same way everywhere in the cosmos as it does here, right? At that point, you would have to start to believe that, like, you know, that what you've been seeing here is probably all you're ever going to see, no matter how far out you go. You know, granted, hominids and dinosaurs look very strange to us. They still had, you know, like two, they were still bilaterally symmetric. They still had two eyes, a nose, a mouth, two ears, four limbs, right? And they were still based on the same information system, which is RNA, DNA, right? Now, for the purpose of our little discussion here, I mean, the Sun-Jupiter system and the Saturn-Mars-Earth system may as well have been 50 or 100 light years apart. You understand what I'm saying? You've got this perfect double. You've got exactly the situation I just described. You've got, like, you know, two separate solar systems, and you've got, like, two separate living worlds, but they're essentially recognizable. You know, they're both based on the same information system. And, you know, the kinds of creatures certainly look different from the one to the other. I mean, you know, they're having been modified and adapted to different conditions, but they're the same kinds of living creatures. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think, Henrik, that you know, sort of lends itself to what we're talking about, Sheldrake's morphic fields, that
right,
nature
right.
produces things according to habit.
That's right.
You know, you could think of a morphic field as a cosmic archetype, I mean, sort of like Plato's ideals.
And then out of that, of course, we get, you know, the results of what we have today, which is fascinating. And again, that could just also explain, you know, the potential problem that we tried to get to before of how we have a transfer from one area to another. You could basically have a lesser life or maybe even microbial life being transferred. And then out of that, you do get a kind of a progression or a kind of an evolution, perhaps, which would do.
Sure, literally,
you know,
explain
a
downloading
it.
Of the template.
That's yeah. right. Yeah. yeah.
Okay. Well, you're talking about a template. You're not talking about humans evolving from microbes or anything like that. I mean, you know, like I say, Cro-Magnon man arrived here on this planet fully formed.
That is amazing. Yeah, that is, you know, occur. But exactly, who the heck knows, right? Who the heck knows how it was how it really happened?
Well, this is what we're saying. We don't answer every question which people are going to have. You know, in other words, particularly the question as to the exact mechanism by which humans arrived here from the Jovian system, from Ganymede, right? We simply don't have the time machine which it would take to understand that. You know, what we do come up with, I mean, several of the questions which we do answer are very big ones. You know, the question of where humans come from originally, the question of the time lapse between Cro-Magnon man and the familiar antediluvian people of the Bible. There's no way to believe that Adam and Eve or the people of the Bible were descended from Cro-Magnons. There would be a list of things which Jewish literature and the Bible would have to know about, which basically they just don't know anything about. I mean, you know, the Bible and Jewish literature would have to know something about the atlatl. Certainly that was the signature weapon of all Cro-Magnon people. They would have to know something about hominids and some kind of a war against hominids. They would have to know something, you know, about this Purple Dawn Age, right, which the Bible and Jewish literature don't really go into or know anything about, right? There's a list of things like that. You know, again, this is what Troy and I come to. You've got two basic groups of people on the planet. You've got Cro-Magnons, and then you've got the antediluvian people of the Bible. I mean, this is not a racial thing at all. It's basically just a question of the original cultures and technologies having been different. We figure
sure.
Either of the two groups, any color or any feature that you would find in modern humans, very little genetic variation in modern humans. I mean, apparently, from what I read, there's less genetic variation in the entire human race right now than there is in a typical group of 40 or 50 African monkeys of the same species. Okay. Like I said, what we've done explains the time lapse. The fact that Saturn, the Saturnian system, approached the sun on a spiral is the thing which explains the time lapse. In other words, you're only going to get transfers at the point of near approach, and then the thing would swing back out into deep space again.
Troy, anything additional to add to that?
Yeah, I just think that the predictive quality of what we've put out there in Cosmos and Collision is that any exploration of Ganymede should turn up some very, very interesting objects or artifacts.
Indeed. I mean, this question, of course, where we come from when it comes to human origins is one of the most interesting questions there is, and this book will definitely take you into a completely new area. Well, it's a great job on the book, gentlemen. This is a fascinating read with some extraordinary propositions. Great stuff. Before we wrap up, I'd like to give out your websites again, of course. The main one, as we've been talking about, cosmosincollision.com. That's where you can pick up the Kindle version of the book today, and as well, as far as I know, there will be a paperback version available at some point as well, guys, right?
Paperback and hardbound copies a couple of months out.
Really good stuff. Also, Troy's website, SaturnDeathCult.com, and Ted's BearFabrique.com. We'll have these linked up there as well. Well, thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your time coming on our program, sharing everything with us here today. So good job, guys.
Thank you very much, Henrik.
Thank you very much, Henrik, it's like I really enjoyed this. This is, you know, a very good opportunity for us.
We have more guests and new programs in the pipeline for you coming up. The current list is in our radio archive, but we do have next Ulla Damgård for the fourth and last part of our series that we've been doing on the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. After this, Harry Hubbard, and then Patrick Henningsen on the Boston bombings. Thank you for being a member and for listening. I wish you have a great day or evening, and we will talk to you soon.